Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys on The Legal Geeks. The following episode was recorded live at WonderCon. It is our Lawyers vs. Kaiju panel that asked the question, what is the liability for monster attacks? This panel was moderated by my good friend, Matt Weinhold. He's one of the four podcasters on Monster Party. Matt goes way back to Rooster Teeth Feathers, great comedian, fun guy, did a great job moderating multiple lawyers talking about monsters. And the panel included Monty Cooper from Oric. Monty is the grandnephew of Marion Cooper, who created King Kong. Monty knows a lot about King Kong, Mighty Joe Young, Son of Kong. Fun guy. Megan Hitchcock, Esquire from eSurance.
Mothra is my favorite, by the way. Raved
the viewing list I gave her of Mothra vs. Godzilla, King Kong, did a great job. Geraldine Sane Edwards, she was a ton of fun and also did a lot of homework. And myself, because I do love Gamera, Godzilla, Mothra, and all other kaiju. So we had a great time talking about these issues. So enjoy.
Welcome to Lawyers vs. Kaiju! We're in a good place. Well, what we're going to see tonight is it's kind of a reflection of what my good friend Josh Gilliland and his co-host Jessica Peterson do. They do a podcast called The Legal Geeks. And what they do is they get actual attorneys and they get together, or maybe on a guest, and they will discuss the legal ramifications of things that happen in the world of science fiction and horror and comic books. Sounds like fun, right? Yes.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great podcast. We all learn a lot, but they do all kinds of different subjects, Star Wars and the Marvel Universe and all kinds of the things that we don't know. But this show is about lawyers versus kaiju. So let's get to it. Let's get to our representational talent here. We have, introducing our distinguished panel of legal experts, we have from Oric, we have the grandnephew of the creator of King Kong, Marion C. Cooper. Welcome, Monty Cooper! Next, from the law offices of Geraldine Sane Edwards, we have Geraldine Sane Edwards! Unbelievable. Then from eSurance, it's kaiju lawyer extraordinaire. We have Megan Hitchcock. Megan Hitchcock, who is not the grandniece of Albert Hitchcock, just to clear that up. Unless that is, I'm already babysitting. So, and then finally, we have the host of The Legal Geeks. Right here, it's Josh Gilliland. Josh! So let's step right into it. Let's get this kaiju court in session, if you will. Who pays for acts of Godzilla?
Tokyo.
Alright, let's move on. Clear up. But does your homeowner's insurance cover being stepped on? Now, Megan and Josh, if you wouldn't mind handling this, who does pay for the acts of Godzilla?
So, just being in-house counsel for eSurance, I can just give you a little brief thing. I'm pretty sure in your policy, if you're a homeowner, you do not. There's nothing in there for acts of Godzilla. however, going through various policies, they're not going to cover earth movement, which it also applies whether it's caused from human or animal forces. So whether Godzilla is actually an animal or human forces, is that not working for me? Oh, hello. But they do cover direct loss by fire, loss, theft, or explosion. So if Godzilla steps on your house and it explodes, yes, they'll cover it. If there's anything falling, like as he's knocking crap over and things fall under your house, yes, they'll cover that. But there is a caveat, because technically Godzilla has some nuclear issues, they do not cover that. In fact, it is specifically excluded. So, yes, and as are acts of decisions, including the failure to act or decide by a government body. So should the government decide not to act and save your house, then you're still screwed. Sorry. I know. The things in your policy. This is seriously, this is a 85-page policy that I just went through. You guys are already for a nap, right? But no, Josh, so technically, if you're gonna claim anything from Godzilla or King Kong, any of those big giant monsters, say something fell on your house and it exploded. That'll work for you.
What if another house falls on your house?
That still works.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. Stepping, not so much.
So the idea is to lure him to your neighbor's house.
Yes, so like flares, whatever you got, and then if he knocks stuff over and it flies onto your house, you're good.
Sweet.
Exactly. However, think of when Godzilla comes ashore, if there's a tsunami,
yeah, no water.
Do you have flood insurance?
No, not covered.
So make sure you're covered there. You don't want a Katrina situation where you have homeowners insurance but no flood insurance. And then you're arguing, did the levee cause the damage to your house or did Godzilla? But that brings us to the next issue.
Okay.
Of local governments.
Yeah, can a local government cover emergency costs?
So, we don't have any cases where giant monsters have invaded a city and caused damage. I know there are children who do lots of damage. Exactly. But we do have cases where there are oil spills or airplanes crashing in the neighborhoods. And in those cases, we actually had towns sue an airline trying to recover their emergency costs because the airplane crashed into their town and they had to respond with fire engines, ambulances, emergency room costs. And the answer to that is, can they sue the airlines to recover costs? The answer is no, because public expenditures made in the performance of government functions are not recoverable. So if you look at a movie like the original Godzilla or Godzilla 2014, the city of San Francisco would be on its own to cover the costs from the Godzilla attack. Now, the problem with that is no federal government, well, maybe the current one, would say, California, you're on your own.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah,
And thinking back the last 6 months, they've done that now like twice. So local governments have to incur those costs. Now you might wonder, what about a nuclear bomb being put onto a pilot boat that in no way could get far enough away from San Francisco in time and probably would have detonated the bomb right at the Golden Gate Bridge, and then the nuclear tsunami would have made the entire Bay Area uninhabitable? You can't sue the federal government for that. There have been people who have sued for damage to houses after nuclear weapons tests, saying like, oh, my windows cracked, my walls cracked. No recovery. You can't sue the federal government and recover from nuclear tests. So they're not gonna waive sovereign immunity for that issue for a bomb that went off and should have given everyone lymphoma and destroyed San Francisco.
I will note that Oakland, Newport, and Berkeley is a nuclear-free zone by definition.
Yeah, and so is Davis.
What if what about when it comes to, what if you have, you're growing pot and government demand?
They'll arrest you.
That wasn't really any part of the panel. I was just curious.
They'll arrest you, okay. And you are going to go to federal court.
Okay.
And you're going to be arrested in court.
Yeah, not the fun federal prison.
Yeah.
Oh, I miss those guys. Okay. All right. Next up here, is King Kong protected by the Endangered Species Act? Now, this one has to go to our Kong expert.
I offer the fact that I'm biased on this situation.
you're
talking about a family member.
Yes.
Now, an endangered species, by federal law, is endangered in its range. It is designated by the United States government to be threatened or endangered. It can be one of two categories. You would think that a great ape, who is the last of its kind, known in biology as an endling, the possibility of extinction existing with its death, would be the quintessential endangered species under the ESA. Alas, my cousin, so to speak, is not protected by the Endangered Species Act. I know. The minute that ape steps into New York, he is critically endangered by definition.
Giuliani had all the giant apes cleaned out of Times Square.
Well, as I've pointed out in the past, the minute you step on Skull Island, by definition, humans are the endangered species. But therein lies the problem. King Kong is not native to the United States or North America, and the Endangered Species Act only covers species that are native to our continent. And second of all, you have to be designated by the government. To date, King Kong species has not been listed as an endangered species, partly because it's not clear what species it is.
So King Kong actually has to sign up for this before it takes effect, which by going to the place to sign up, he would destroy that building.
That is correct. Now, there is a related convention, International Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, called CITES. Now, CITES is familiar to many of you because it's the treaty that prevents, for instance, the sale of whale parts or gorilla parts from Africa in international trade and conventions that are designed to protect species outside the United States. And we do, in fact, have joint treaties with all of our a number of countries, including Japan, Canada, and Mexico. So there you would think my cousin finally has his out. The only problem is Skull Island, by definition, isn't part of that treaty because it doesn't belong to any country. Hence, in the most recent Kong, President Nixon could send in the U.S. military to kill or capture it, which, once again, leaves my family despondent. There is, I will qualify, that even though my beloved Kong is not protected as an endangered species, he also suffers from a kaiju problem that all but a couple suffer from. He is, by definition, an invasive species. Kaiju, that's what they do. They invade. And invasive species are, by definition, not protected by the Endangered Species Act or any other convention. So, you know, when Godzilla decided to whack San Francisco a good one, that was probably because he knew he couldn't be held accountable since he's also not a protected species.
Right.
However, for those of you nerds out there like myself who would like to think if there are any kaiju that might be protected, there are two. Hedora was actually spawned in the North American continent by atomic bombs dropped by, I believe, the Russians after they were shot down by the Americans, and he took it out on Tokyo, like all kaiju does.
Also known as the Swamp Monster.
Gamera.
Now, the other one is another family member, a lesser known one. My great uncle also was the producer of the original Mighty Joe Young. Now, Mighty Joe Young is what you might call a vertically challenged kaiju. He's only 14 feet or so. But he is a Western gorilla. and he was captured and brought to the United States in both the original and in the remake illegally. As a result, he's also one of the few kaiju who has a happy ending because he's returned to his native country as the law would require. He is the best example of a kaiju that is protected by federal law.
And so the fact that Kong was brought to America, I guess that was legal in the sense that they had worked out something or some sort of, like bringing back a tiger or whatever.
He was drugged, chained, brought back as essentially a Weinstein actor. In New York, I would say that constitutes illegal action, except that he's not a protected species, so we'll talk later about who is liable for that.
That's terrible.
He could. Is this
the email? Just a little
closer.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So, if that was the case, then he would be a victim. So maybe he could get some protection under immigration law if he was a human, but he's not.
At least human, right?
Yeah.
So, not under his president.
Yeah. So it's not. Yeah. No. All bets are off now. Yeah. Oh, man, this is rough stuff. All right. Well, an adjacent question. Let's move on to Gamera. We all love Gamera, right? Gamera is a giant nuclear power flying turtle who is the friend of all children. You know, you drop an atomic bomb on a culture and it changes them forever. So, I guess what we need to know is, what he does is he likes to save children from kaiju, from other monsters. And so, does he have a responsibility to rescue kids from monsters? Does he have any kind of legal responsibility to do this? Geraldine, are you taking this one, or no? Actually, let's go to Josh.
Yeah.
And then Geraldine, you just jump in. Whenever you get angry, just jump in. Because I'm telling you, this Gamera topic is going to make it.
So let's talk about the hero turtle that is unique amongst kaiju. In the original Gamera, he is in the traditional villain type role. He's woken up by an atomic bomb detonated at the North Pole, which there's a lot of issues with that. But in the subsequent films, we see him saving children left and right. It's a common trope. And whether it's fighting Gauss, he saves a kid rides on his back. We see him rescue Boy Scouts who are kidnapped by space aliens. And as a scout leader, I can say those uniforms are accurate. There is a Far East Council. There were joint U.S. and Japanese scout adventures together, still are, but we would never, ever, ever, ever send two Boy Scouts out in a submersible submarine alone. The insurance is nightmarish.
Well, now, wait a minute. Didn't they steal it?
No. They go to the scout leaders. No, we can make it work. And they cruise off.
And they just run in there.
No. No. And Gamera goes swimming by. And the comment is, he's the friend to all children. That's cool. We see him spot weld the spaceship back together, and he starts flying through space to save children from a planet on the opposite side of the sun. So does any of that create a legal duty?
Once you're off the planet, I think it's done.
Right? Well, we're applying common law principles here. So under traditional legal principles, there's no duty to rescue. And that has started to change in some states because you can literally watch someone die and go like, yeah, I didn't have to go save them. You have no duty to rescue. However, there are exceptions to that. If there's a statute, like police officers can't go like, whoa, that's dangerous. I'm not going in. Firemen, that's a bad fire. I could get hurt. No, that's their job. Oh, you could have a contractual relationship. There are situations where that exists. Or there's the implied one, where by the very virtue of like being on an adventure together or some relationship such as like even parent-child, there's a duty that you could have to go rescue people. Well, when you think of Gamera, you wouldn't have them give them a responsibility of saving every child on the planet. Because whenever we see him go out and start saving kids, it's because they were kidnapped by aliens. Now, just as a point of negotiation, when the aliens in like three movies said, surrender the planet so we could use you as food or else the children die, the answer to that is, well, we can't let the children die. No, the answer to that is, open fire.
Yeah. We don't give a chance.
Yeah, it's...
eat the kids.
The kids are going to die anyway at this point, so we're going to stop them from invading the Earth. However...
but then they'll just want more kids. Yeah, it is when you eat kids.
However,
I can't stop. They'll go through all that.
Exactly. However, the fact Gamera goes around saving kids who get kidnapped by aliens does create an implied duty that if that happened to a kid, Gamera probably would go out and save them. So, possibly.
But so, now, Gamera is a creature, so just the mere fact that he's like, he's this intelligent monster, but we don't really know how smart he is. So it'd be like, you can't sue a dolphin, can you?
No, and there. It depends what era of Gamera we're looking at. If we're looking at the Showa Gamera, definitely more of the monster, but he goes around saving people, and he does spot well the UFO, so there's some intelligence there. On the flip side, when we get to the Heisei Gamera, which in the 1990s, which that trilogy is probably the best kaiju trilogy ever.
It's
amazing trilogy. In that, he is a guardian, the guardian of the universe, made by an ancient race of humans. They really don't get into whether it's Atlantis or what the history is, but there's at least a duty in, you know, directed from his initial creators that were human to protect humanity against Gauss. And when you have Steven Seagal's daughter as the initial priestess who was communicating with Gamera, there's definitely an intelligence factor there.
I don't think you want any of them in the Seagal family.
No, but she did a good job. She did a good job in that film.
Okay. All right, well, then moving on. Okay. Carl Denham brought King Kong. He's kind of led the expedition to get Kong, brings him back. Now, as we know, Kong does a lot of damage. And so what is Carl Denham's liability for King Kong's rampage across New York? And Geraldine, I think you should take this one.
Yeah, this one's mine, right? Okay, so I'm supposed to push this button and then I can talk instead. Does that sound right?
No, I think it should be on.
Well, if you can't hear me, just okay. It'll be louder.
Yeah.
So there's negligence, and then with negligence, there's also strict liability, right? If you have a wild animal on your property, then you are strictly liable. Is King Kong a wild animal? I would say, yeah, he's a wild animal. Did Mr. Demme have control of this animal? Now, I only watched two movies. So, the original 1933 one, and then this Shin Godzilla one. So, I don't know about the other movies. For this particular movie, he brought the King Kong into New York, and then he did a theater kind of show. So he was almost like, you know, the brothers for the Ringling Barney Circus, right? It's kind of like that. That's what he was trying to make money out of. So to most normal people, a reasonable, prudent person would assume that he has control of that animal, which we all know he didn't really have control, right? But it was his animals, and he was making profits from it. So he would be strictly liable for all damage that happened. Now there's something about zookeepers and they're not liable, but zookeeping is for the public. It is, you know, this particular thing is for profit. It is not a non-profit. So if you're a zookeeper, then you wouldn't have liability. But since Carl was not a zookeeper, he was a movie director, he would be liable for all damage.
Which, if you watch Son of Kong, they actually do a great job of having Denham being in 11 lawsuits and a grand jury indicting him. So, kudos to your granduncle for that.
I'll also note that my great uncle, for those of you who are into trivia, is the pilot who actually, along with Ernest Stroustad, my great uncle was in fact the pilot. It was very important to him that he be the one that shoots Kong in the final sequence off of the Empire State Building.
That's
so he relieved his own character of liability at that point.
Phew, huh? Okay. Well, now, in Godzilla, King Kong versus Godzilla, he is matched against this, of course, one of the most famous monsters of all time. And there's a Mr. Taco, who had King Kong captured as part of a marketing effort for a pharmaceutical company. And he was ordered by the Japanese Coast Guard to not bring Kong in. So what I would like to know, what are the, you know, who acted more responsibly? Was it Mr. Taco? Was it Carl Venom? Monty, if you could shine a new light on this.
Well, for those who really want to know interesting qualities about the law and how old it is, the notion that wild animals give rise to strict liability goes back to Roman law. There's actually a Roman term for it. If you think about Rome, it makes sense. They were bringing lions and all sorts of other things to kill people in the Colosseum, and naturally that gave rise to problems when those animals got out. It is actually one of the strongest foundations of tort law in existence. And so, it's very clear that both Mr. Denham and Mr. Taco are going to learn what it means to be medieval in law. I would say that, at least in the case of Denham, he actually had a commercial purpose and a logical use for Kong and initially restrained it. In fact, what causes Kong in multiple versions to go haywire is because of the photographers and the immediate press, who's the rather interesting topical, you know, with paparazzi to this day.
Right.
It was viewed that King Kong would be possessive of the main lady,
Anne
Barrow, so he should have known that, hey, if something's going on with her, that King Kong might try to escape, and he does have, even though it was made out of whatever steel, right, that he could escape. He should have known, right?
That's
also a basis of common law.
And yes, it shouldn't be the common rule, just be as nice as he possibly can to a giant gorilla. Like,
well,
you know,
yeah, there
I mean,
you don't make him mad.
Play it safe. Yeah. Lots of bananas, and, you know, some, like a memory foam pillow, just something.
Yeah.
Now, contrast Denham, who is just a director, with Taco, who is instructed by his government not to go get Kong.
Yes, right!
And does so anyway with an armed transport. Now, he brings Kong back to Tokyo, and guess what happens? That actually instigates an entirely different kaiju, Godzilla, to get mad. I would say, Mr. Taco, it's almost hard not to figure out what laws he didn't violate, in fact. In fact, it's not even clear he got the right regulations to bring Kong in for pharmaceutical purposes.
It turns out he doesn't own a pharmaceutical company either. He's just selling Vicodin, you know.
So in the grand scheme of things, yeah, it's not an accident that Taco, although he gets out of it, sort of, Denham and Son of Kong becomes rich.
Right. And if you've seen that movie, Mr. Taco is so bloody annoying that I'm sure the judge just added, you know, penalties on top just for that. Just like, oh, get him out of here. Okay. Moving on. All right. This one is very special to me. This is one of my favorite kaiju movies. And I don't know if you guys have seen it, but you should see it. And it's kind of one of the lesser known kaiju movies. Everyone knows all the Godzilla movies, but this is a movie called War of the Gargantuas. Anyone? Oh, yes.
Oh,
so good.
What a great kaiju movie.
It's... No, yeah. People representing War of the Gargantuas. And so, in the film, there is a green gargantua. There are two gargantuas. It's like a Cain and Abel type story. There's a green one, there's a brown one. And the brown one is the nice one. The green one is this horrible people-eating monstrosity. And so the brown one is raised by a group of scientists. And so they have a, you know, a connection to the green one, but are they in any way for the rampage that ends up ensuing with the gargantuas, do they have any kind of financial responsibility or legal responsibility for Gyra's actions? And Megan, this is your favorite film, so I thought I'd let you have this film.
Sadly, this is my least favorite film. It made me cry. I can't even imagine that. It made me cry. It was sad. He lost his friend. Come on.
But it moved you. It did,
and I hope I never see that one again. But, okay, so this all comes back to foreseeability. So, like, is it foreseeable that Gyra is going to be eating people, you know? So if you look at Sanda, raised by scientists, he's nice, he's friendly, he's playing with a purse, he's drinking milk, everything's cool, he's defending people, everything's cool. And then he escapes and goes into the water. And once he's in the water, a piece slips off of him, and lo and behold, while they're testing nuclear weapons in that water, strangely, things mutate. So I feel like with the radioactivity that's going on there, there may be some government liability if we look at Chernobyl. However, at this point, they did not have Chernobyl, so they may not have known about those crazy-ass side effects. But if we look, I know hindsight's 20/20, so, you know. But he comes out, they're thinking, oh, he's just like Sanda, it's cool, and then he starts eating people and then spitting out their dresses. I don't know, very weird.
It's great to see him.
But once they realize that Gyra was created by sloughing off of Sanda's cells, there's going to be some possible liability depending on how they act on that. So, you know, obviously, initially, they don't know how Gyra is going to act. Because Sanda's all nice, and they look like they're friends. It's not really a son. It's more of a clone-ish sort of thing. So there was no expectation that Sanda was going to eat people. So you wouldn't initially expect that he was going to eat people. However, when he starts doing so, maybe, you know, think about what you're going to do. Now, if they already know that the sloughing off of the cells is going to cause a problem, you're going to just create a pinata of monsters. At that point, if you try to destroy him, so that might be a problem. So we could actually go back, and thank you, Monty, for this, by the way. We could actually go back all the way back to how did Sanda get to be small from big? Well, that was some Nazi testing. So maybe we should just blame them for all this, because this all came from that. But there's also the issue of the fact that Sanda went into the water when he was a kid, so statute of limitations is over. Sorry, no liability. I know.
And not even, he doesn't have to pay for the dress that he spit out?
Well, he may have to pay for the dry cleaning.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
Yeah.
The other thing with that is that this is not necessarily a legal thing, but you know they're always trying to find these monsters. You know, they lose them for a while in a kaiju movie, and then they're like, oh, we discovered where they are. Like, how do you not know where the giant monster is at all times, right? Like, how does a giant kaiju get lost in the woods? Like, no, I don't buy it.
Well, and they know where Mothra is, so, like, I find that very weird. Like, Mothra's just hanging off on an island.
Yeah, well, it's Infant Island.
Exactly.
It's not on many maps, but you can find it. You ask around.
Fine.
Ask someone around Fiji, you know.
I am from Fiji.
Okay. Godzilla. Now, Godzilla wreaks a lot of havoc in Japan. Does the United States have any treaty obligation to defend Japan from Godzilla? And, Geraldine, take this one, please.
Sure.
Make us all wiser.
So, the second movie that I watched, the Shin Godzilla, I watched it, and that was in the military, and I watched it again. I watched it twice, just to make sure I didn't miss anything. And yes, there is a treaty. After the war, we had so many interests still in Japan. So the U.S. did not want to just leave Japan. So they said, "Well, let's make a treaty," and they wouldn't end the war until they had a treaty. So they have this Japan and U.S. security treaty, and basically the reason for it, besides the fact that the U.S. wanted to make sure that we still had assets in Japan and that our money was being well spent, that we want to make sure the world is secure and things to that effect. So we have a mutual agreement. If something happens, we'll help defend it. So there is a possibility, and they talk about it in the movie as well, let's get the U.S.'s help, and in the end, U.S. does actually help. So yes, they have a treaty. Yes, the U.S. should help, because the spirit of that treaty is to make sure there's peace in that area. Also, we also have, I think last count, about 50,000 U.S. soldiers in Japan. We also, and then have dependents, about 40,000. But that is from Wikipedia, I'm not sure if they'll quote me on that. So, I would say, in the spirit of the treaty, granted, King Kong wasn't, you know, another country invading, yes, I think we would help Japan.
And I would think that NATO also,
Yes, with the UN, the UN Council, as soon as Godzilla attacks, you need to tell the Security Council that, hey, this thing is attacking, we need help, and then they decide, and then they help, right?
Like they didn't notice.
All the golf course. Everyone was at Mar-a-Lago.
You know, having lots of other meetings.
Okay. Well, all right. In that same kind of area, does the president have to request congressional approval to fight Godzilla?
Yes and no. He does not need approval if the conflict is going to be less than 60 days or up to 90 days, he can send troops overseas to help defend Japan against Godzilla, as long as it's not going to be longer than 60 days plus 30 days for withdrawing. So 90 days, really. The War Powers Act was installed after Vietnam, because we didn't want to go into wars that we couldn't win. By the way, Vietnam was not a war. It was not recognized by Congress. They never lost a war. That's a side note. Anyways, so the president doesn't need Congress's approval. However, he might want to think about getting that approval if the mission is going to be longer than 60 days.
Which it could be.
Now, in Godzilla, I think it was only 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I was trying to figure out the timeline, so in that case, it would not be.
A lot happens very quickly.
A lot happens. And we already have troops in Japan, so, you know, you have to worry about transporting them and all that stuff.
I would think also that you'd be able to get Congress's approval by just showing some footage. Like, this is what's happening in Japan right now. Next is Hawaii. Well, we see we're going on recess, so we can't get back in the month. Okay. All right. Now, in the movie, as we know it, it's called Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster, and in Japan, the character is known as Hedorah. And Hedorah is basically made up of just any kind of garbage, waste, toxic waste. And so, our companies that caused the pollution that made up Hedorah financially liable for Hedorah cleanup costs. And Monty, you're a big Hedorah fan.
I am.
Go for it.
All right, we live in Southern California, right? If there's anything that this part of the country understands, it's smog. So, it would seem obvious that if Hedorah was created here in the United States, two things would happen. First of all, in Southern California, the response would be, you knew it was coming. Second of all, it would, in fact, probably give rise to lots and lots of liability. We have amongst the most robust environmental regulations in the world. We have the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the CERCLA, RCRA, IRTA, the National Energy Policy, and a whole host of other regulations, all of which may apply to this particular monster because he's created by all sorts of pollution. One of those laws, CERCLA, does in fact allow any party just who is potentially partially liable for pollution, including Clean Air Act pollution, to sue any other party that is partially contributed to it. It would be a Southern California environmentalist law dream if this monster invaded.
Yes.
The problem is he invades Tokyo. Tokyo does have some laws. It has laws about noxious odors, it has laws, it does have Clean Air Act laws. They're a little more lax. We never do see any particular reason, but you can imagine that this is a noxious monster. Certainly Godzilla has noxious breath. So it is possible that it would give rise to liability even in Tokyo and Japan, but not to the same extent as it would here in the United States.
Wow. Did you just feel that rumble, by the way?
Is that Godzilla's?
You really pissed off Heather. He's coming for him.
Now, if it's all the same, I would like to contrast Heather with two other guys that are also.
Please do? Wow.
So just by show of hands, how many of you have seen the 2006 Korean movie, The Host?
Yes.
Now, The Host is unique in kaiju films in that it's actually rooted in inspiration by a true event. Ben Junhong, who has gone on to great fame as a result of this movie, including making such movies as Snowpiercer and some others, was inspired by an actual event in 2000 in which a mortician on a United States military base dumped several bottles of formaldehyde into the Han River. For those of you who have seen the movie The Host, and you will note that that is almost precisely how this movie begins, and it's not an accident. That dumping of that formaldehyde became an actual international political issue as it related to our relations to South Korea in the early 2000s. It also resulted, incidentally, in the mortician being prosecuted in absentia by the South Korean government in order to pay, I believe, and the United States government ultimately did pay something like $4,000 in civil fines. However, as that might seem to many of you, you know, if you dump several bottles of formaldehyde into a United States stream, you are looking at quite a bit more civil liability than $4,000. That's because, and as the movie intimates, our laws are rather relaxed for environmental contamination into international waters or other tributaries when it occurs on a foreign, a military base. A fact that is not well known, but is true. Most of our environmental laws are rigorously enforced in the United States if the military base is here in the U.S. or on North American properties. But outside the U.S., that's a different rule. And in fact, in late 2015, the Obama administration entered into bilateral negotiations for a treaty with Japan that actually was intended to strengthen our relationship with environmental contamination as it related to Okinawa. And it was criticized because even though it was amongst most rigorous ever developed, it still only required the United States to cooperate with investigation of its contaminating activities with Japan if it so desired. That's actually the standard across most of our military bases across the United States. So going back to The Host, many of you may remember, nothing happens to the U.S. government in that movie. In fact, the title of the movie is because the U.S. government's role is covering up its activities by making a false representation adopted by the Korean government that this is a biological breakdown. Then the United States does another thing. It decides it will contribute to trying to containing the kaiju in The Host through the rather obvious metaphorical term, Agent Yellow, another environmental weapon that has had interesting environmental regulation in years of being Agent Orange is the inspiration. And of course, even used against this Korean populace, there's no indication the United States is held accountable. One funny thing about this, the Host became the most highest grossing movie of any kind in South Korean history. Made Ben Jung a celebrity in its own right, rightfully so, and it also elicited praise from the North Korean government, something you would not normally see.
Yeah, they often play that movie with Paul Dusari, if you know that one. That's the North Korean giant kaiju movie.
Now, there is one other kaiju that was created by environmental conditions, and that, of course, is Shin Godzilla, who was created by radiation. Again, implied potentially as a result of U.S. activity. So, you know, when it comes to creating kaiju by contamination, we're really pretty good at it. Again, radioactivity and radiation is one of the most heavily regulated forms of contamination in the United States. Even a few microcuries can get you in a lot of trouble. Japan is rather sensitive to it in light of the Fukushima events and has created some rather rigorous laws itself related to contamination. If Shin Godzilla were to have been created after Fukushima, I believe even the Japanese government would find liability.
Okay. That's a great double feature, by the way, the host and Shin Godzilla, I suggested. Okay. Now, there is a movie called, we know it in this country as Godzilla vs. the Thing. It's also known as Mothra vs. Godzilla. Now, in this movie, a large Mothra egg is found on a beach. And so what I would like to know is who owns the egg in Mothra vs. Godzilla? Because you've got the Mothra egg on Infant Island washes up. The egg is rescued by fishermen. Local villagers sell the egg to Happy Enterprises. So who is the rightful owner? Who owns this damn egg? And that would be to you, Megan and Josh.
All right. Well, so this was my favorite because somebody was on a lot of LSD when they made this movie. So initially, like, it rolls into the water. It's a giant egg. Like, how many things are gonna like bring that up? And within pretty much an hour, the little singing ladies that are cracking me up.
The peanuts.
Yes. Thank you. They quickly tell everyone, this is our egg, we'd like it back, and it's going to cause massive violence trying to get back to their island if the egg starts here. So we're trying to help you, help us get it back. So they're pretty much on, everyone is pretty much on notice, except for those poor fishermen. but everyone else is on notice that these ladies are basically trying to own the egg, or at least expressing ownership of the egg. The fishermen, while I want to give them so much credit for going out there and saying it's theirs, not really, because it's pretty obvious that giant egg didn't come from everybody or anything. And as soon as it goes around, oh, that's Mothra's egg, everybody's like, oh, yeah, it's Mothra's egg. So they all knew. And you can't really purchase something. Like, if you purchase something that unknowingly is not yours, then sometimes the purchaser ends up owning the egg. But here, the purchaser, Happy Enterprises, they're a little shady, and pretty sure they knew, not theirs, wasn't the fisherman's to sell, because they totally lowballed them on the price. And so I'm thinking that they don't really own the egg. I'm going back with the island and the people.
I would offer another theory showing that they never had a claim of ownership to the egg, either the fishermen or Happy Enterprises. There's a wonderful case that law students learn in the first 2 weeks of law school, and that's a case called Genn v. Rich, which involves whalers. And whalers went out and killed a whale, but they couldn't bring the whale back with them, so they left something called a bomb lance in the whale as a mark of appropriation, saying, this is our whale corpse, and we're going to do all the things to have clean burning lamp oil. And
it's like their American flag in the moon.
So when you look at Mothra's egg, that doesn't have a bomb lance in it, but you can go, there's marks of appropriation here. Who else lays giant eggs like this? There's a color pattern on it that could show where it came from.
Yeah, as soon as you see the giant egg, you're like, that's Mothra's.
Yeah. Literally, it's like, no. It's like, you can't build an amusement park around it and think, hey, we're going to sell tickets waiting for this thing to hatch, when you were warned that larvae are going to come out of it and want to eat. That seems like a really bad plan. So, Happy Enterprise...
I'd go, though. Wouldn't you go?
Yeah,
I'd go to that.
I go.
So Happy Enterprises never had a valid claim of ownership because the fishermen never had a right to sell it. They were committing an act of conversion upon Infant Island and the Peanuts and telling the fairies, no, we sold your egg. And for the fact that Happy Enterprises offered to buy the fairies, okay, this is a really evil company, and they kind of got what they deserved when Godzilla stomped on the hotel with them in it.
They're basically eliciting prostitution. I mean, they were trying to sell and buy women.
There's something called the Mann Act, which is ironically named Man with two N's, that prohibits transferring women across state lines for illicit purposes.
Especially tiny ones,
right? Yes, well, yeah.
So,
get doubly fined.
Exactly. So, if they were in the United States, that would completely be violating federal law on so many levels. So, so with that, we have like maybe a minute or two left. So,
you want to open this up to some questions?
Yeah. So, any quick questions? Yes, sir.
Is there any legal precedent for the federal government to compel insurance companies to cover attacks in the case of like Pacific Rim, where there's repeated incursions by kaiju, and I guess maybe privatize some of the coverage of the
loss?
Great question. So the question is, could the government compel insurance of some kind for monster attacks? And it'd be like compelling people to have health insurance or people in California to have auto insurance. If you're on notice that we do have giant monsters coming ashore, yeah, you could have, it should come at the state level.
Compelled? No, because it would be through the Insurance Act, but you can, there's a lot of these, like you can get an earthquake rider, you can get a water damage rider, so it just means more money for you, but you can get a rider that will include some of those losses, but a lot of these like acts of war, that's not really covered because they can't, I mean, that's going to be everybody.
I also think that it could be like pre-existing conditions and saying the government saying that all those provisions are now illegal. So you can't just, you know, you can't have those clauses in your insurance contracts anymore. There's a gentleman in the brown sweater.
I think the one movie where Godzilla was a big fan, they bounced down from the mountain, and there's now another country decided to do a nuclear test, so Godzilla wakes up again. So as far as that other country is concerned, are they reliable, or is that even
possible? Well, that was their fault.
That's... If Godzilla is a known entity and detonating a nuclear bomb would cause Godzilla to wake up in another country, there I would hate to be their Secretary of State. I mean, that's bad PR right there. Sorry, I didn't mean for that to happen. No, they haven't stopped us yet. So
no, I saw them.
Oh, you did?
Oh, you saw.
Okay, then we're done. We'll be outside. Thank you all. And
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Monty Cooper. Carolyn St. Edwards. Megan Hinchcock. And Josh Gilman. Woo! And Mel Reinhold. I love each and every one of you.